This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Here in the Sunshine State this week, we've got ourselves a water fight over not enough in the Panhandle and too much in Lake Okeechobee. The two places really highlight the risks and the debate over who controls water and how do they control it. First in the Panhandle, Governor Scott plans to sue the state of Georgia for using too much of it.
So it's having a dramatic impact, and it's because Georgia has taken our water. The Corps of Engineers has not worried about us. That's why Florida is going to file suit against Georgia, take this all the way to the Supreme Court.
Scott may get his fight. The Georgia governor, Nathan Deal, has said the talks with Florida over river water rights have gone silent. This is where we begin the Florida Roundup, talking about water. Tolo Olorunipa with Bloomberg News with us from Tallahassee, and Curtis Morgan covers environmental issues for the Miami Herald. Tolo, let's begin in the capital city. What is this fight all about between water and Florida and Georgia?
Well, this fight has been going on for decades. Florida and Georgia have had this long-running debate over who is entitled to what water. There is this huge river basin that spans the state of Florida and Alabama and Georgia, and the Army Corps of Engineers is responsible for sort of organizing and deciding who gets what out of it. And Florida believes that we're not getting our fair share, and it's been exacerbated over the last year or so because of a pretty drastic drought last year that has had a big impact on our oyster industry, and now the oyster industry has been decimated, and Governor Scott thinks that the best thing to do right now is to take this to the Supreme Court to get it resolved.
This is a fight to some degree between Florida oysters and the suburban and urban sprawl of Atlanta in Georgia. But before we talk about that, Tolo, talk to us about the topography, this river basin involved. Give us an idea of, describe it for us.
Well, it spans the panhandle of Florida, goes all the way up to the northern part of Georgia, and includes parts of Alabama as well. And there are three rivers that are included. It includes the Chattahoochee River, the Apalachicola River, and those are, in Florida, the Apalachicola Bay is the place where, 90% of the oysters in Florida come from that area, and 10% of the oysters in the country come from that area. It's a very important part of the oyster industry. And, the drought last year and the lack of water flowing down from Georgia into that bay is really having a bad impact on the oyster industry there in the Panhandle.
Curtis Morgan with the Miami Herald covering environmental issues. Curtis, this fight over water, as Tolu referred to, has been ongoing for the better part of a couple of decades. What is the source of the debate over this natural resource? Why is this two decades in the making?
Well, it goes on in a lot of water battles. It's a question of, do you use your resources for, to protect the natural environment, the fisheries and things like that, or do you use them for public water supply? And that's the essence of the debate between Georgia and Florida. Alabama's in there as well. I mean, Georgia wants to have all that water up in Lake Lanier. During the drought a couple of years ago, Lake Lanier dropped to historic low levels, and that's an area that they draw water from, but they also use for recreation. And you had these, houses with their boathouses were, 50 feet from the water.
Yeah.
So they've seen impacts as well. But mainly it's between public use and natural resource use. Now, the thing is, with Governor Scott taking this to the Supreme Court, it's already been to the Supreme Court. There's been a long legal fight over this. I think at one point some of the lower courts sided with Florida, and then it went back and forth. And whatever the last ruling was, and I haven't followed this as closely in recent years, whatever the last ruling was, it did go to the Supreme Court, and I believe the Supreme Court declined to hear the case. So I guess you can go forward with some other argument. I'm not exactly sure what the legal strategy will be, but the court did kind of pass judgment on it by not taking it up a few years back.
We're talking about the water fight that developed this week between the state of Florida and Georgia. I suppose maybe a new chapter in this water fight. It's been developing for two decades. And Tolu, what's the precedent here? Is there a current agreement on this water use?
Well, in Georgia, the governor of Georgia has responded recently to this threat of a lawsuit, saying that they've been trying to work with Florida for much of the last couple of years. They said that they sent over an agreement to Florida, and they haven't heard back. The two states have been operating sort of in this limbo of, you know, trying to reach an agreement. The negotiations have been going on for a very long time, and Georgia basically has accused the state of Florida of sort of using this to play up politics right before an election, saying that Governor Scott is trying to look like he's getting tough on the state of Georgia, and sort of using this court battle and this threat of a lawsuit to improve his political standing here with the state of Florida.
And Tolo, before anybody accuses you as a member of the press of being skeptical or cynical by inserting politics, it was a politician who made the political claim. It was the governor of Georgia who claimed that the governor of Florida was playing politics with water, wasn't it?
That's very true. And it's interesting because they're both Republicans, Governor Scott and Governor Nathan Deal of Georgia. They're both Southern Republicans who were elected in 2010 and who faced re-election in 2014. And they've had this long-running negotiation or dispute over water, and now sort of the politics are starting to enter into that dispute as well.
We're talking about water policy in the state of Florida here on the Florida Roundup. Tolo Olorunipa with Bloomberg News, along with us from Tallahassee, Curtis Morgan covering environmental issues in South Florida with the Miami Herald. And this certainly became a federal political issue as well, Curtis, this week, with both of Florida's U.S. senators visiting this area for a Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation hearing on water flows. What is the role of the federal government in all this? The Army Corps of Engineers is the one that usually controls the how much water and how fast the water flows down these rivers.
Are we talking about Lake Okeechobee now?
Well, we're going to move to Lake Okeechobee, but generally speaking, give us the role of the federal government in some of these water issues between the states.
Yeah, the federal government, the Army Corps of Engineers, is in charge of maintaining and operating a lot of the locks and dams in this country, most of them. And so whatever the dam, they built the dam somewhere up there that created Lake Lanier, and they're in charge of its operations. And most of the time, these government agencies, the Corps, will set some sort of management schedule for how they're going to distribute water. And they'll allot X, you know, for agriculture, X for suburban use, and that sort of thing. And I was reading, my colleague Craig Pittman of St. Pete Times did a very nice overview of this story, and I was reading it this morning, and he was saying that In the Corps' management plan, there's nothing in there about oysters in Apalachicola Bay. So they're in the process, I believe, of reviewing their policies of how they distribute the water. But at the moment, you know, the natural resource implications of not sending enough water down Apalachicola Bay are not part of their consideration, although I think they do consider them when they can.
Yeah, Tolo, to Curtis's point, in fact, the current Corps rules don't consider water flows to maintain the river shed up in the panhandle or its bay as, quote, an authorized use. So, I mean, isn't Governor Scott's complaint with the Corps as opposed to with Georgia?
Well, that's the question. Florida has been, I guess, trying to negotiate with the Corps, and they haven't gotten much out of that. So I think the next step would be to try to take on Georgia, who, according to Governor Scott, is consuming more than its fair share. And as you heard in the clip, he says they're consuming our water. So I think Scott believes that Georgia is to blame, so that he's going to take them on directly in the Supreme Court, since he hasn't been able to get very far with the Corps.
And politically speaking, I mean, the governor, you know, when you have a natural disaster, politicians like to stand up and say they're trying to do something. That's just what they do. So, I mean, politics or not, I mean, if you're going to be a leader and you see and there's a natural disaster going on, you're probably going to go out and say you're going to do something. And it's too bad that maybe there's an endangered species somewhere in Apalachicola Bay, because that would give the state some leverage, but I don't know what their legal argument is right now.
No, it's not enough water up in the panhandle, and it is almost too much in Lake Okeechobee. This is the Florida Roundup. Give us a call at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can email us at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com, and tweet us at WLRN on Twitter, or go to the website, wln.org, with an online discussion hosted by our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow, also produced by Elaine Chen. So now, Lake Okeechobee here, Curtis. The Army Corps is also in a spotlight for its management. Some would argue the mismanagement of the water levels. What's the level today? What's the danger?
Well, the level over the last week has come back down. It's inched up to around 16 feet, which is not really a danger zone for the Herbert Hoover Dyke, which is an 80-year-old structure that encircles Lake Okeechobee. The worry is that if the water kept rising, or if we get a hurricane, which can drive the water level up a foot or more in a couple of weeks, then it would enter a danger zone. Above 18, the dike is considered at a high risk of some sort of breach. It hasn't happened in the past, but there's a good deal of concern about it. In the wake of Katrina overtopping the levees around New Orleans and a state report that highlighted the deficiencies of the dike, it's become a major concern. The Corps has begun working on it. So for right now, they're continuing to dump water down these two rivers, the Caloosahatchee on the west coast and the St. Lucie on the east coast. And that is indeed lowering the lake and, easing some of the concerns about the dike, but it's also creating these ripple effects of, toxic algae blooms on both coasts, and residents there and politicians on both coasts are livid.
And I want to ask you about some of the environmental impacts of this policy, but how did we get here? Did the Corps mismanage water flow? Did we seem to have a rainier than usual early summer? How did we get to this point that we're at now,
where
counting half inches now on
Lake O? I don't know if anybody is accusing them of mismanagement at this time. I mean, it's a difficult balance for them. After Katrina, they adopted a new management plan that kept the lake at lower levels, between 12.5 feet and 15.5 feet above sea level, basically. And they did that to ease pressure on the dike. But they're also under pressure to make sure we have enough water during dry season to, feed surrounding communities and sugar farms. So they have to decide, how much to raise and lower it. So as the lake was rising over the last couple of months, they began these releases, and they wanted to do it lightly without damaging these estuaries on either coast. So they started out fairly lightly, but then we had a month of very heavy rain in July in the wrong places, a lot of it north of the lake, and the lake went up a lot.
Well, and as you mentioned here, the real risk here could be if we get some substantial rainfall in a short period of time. Jeff Huffman, meteorologist for Florida Public Radio, joining us from Gainesville. Jeff, welcome to the Florida Roundup. We've got a tropical storm way out in the Atlantic, but one that we certainly have to keep our eye on, because that could be that dump of rain in the week ahead that Lake Okeechobee could have some difficulty swallowing.
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom. Let's hope not. And actually, just probably since you've come on the air, some good news I can share on the former tropical storm, Aaron. It's been downgraded or dissipated to a depression now as of the 11 o'clock advisory from the Hurricane Center. The storm is obviously way out to sea. It is unlikely to survive its trip across the Atlantic, but it is just the beginning of the hurricane season, or at least the peak of the hurricane season, and I already see another wave behind that one that we would have to possibly pay attention to in the coming days.
So, Curtis was making the point about some of the rainfall that happened earlier in the summer in the central part of Florida that fed into Lake Okeechobee. What kind of saturation levels are you seeing here, Jeff, of the topography in central Florida?
Well, it has been an above normal summer for rainfall. In fact, a record-setting summer. Just a couple of days ago, the National Oceanic Administration, NOAA, basically released some information that said the state of Florida has had a record rainiest July. The state as a whole in July received more rain this year than any other July, which is actually impressive, if you will, considering we did not have a significant falling tropical system. And it has been a record-setting year up here in North Florida as well in terms of rainfall, and we're getting hit again up here in North Florida and the Panhandle. So that is true, that we have had above normal rainfall and even almost unprecedented rainfall for the summer, considering we've not had a landfalling significant tropical system.
The good news here for the time being, though, Tropical Storm Aaron downgraded. Jeff Huffman, meteorologist at Florida Public Radio, joining us from Gainesville. Thanks for passing along that good news. So Curtis, maybe perhaps less of a rainfall risk in the week ahead here as that storm begins moving its way toward the Caribbean.
Yeah, let's hope so. I think that the levels of the lake is at right now, however, are going to make this a concern throughout the hurricane season.
All right. This, of course, brings up the issue of insurance, gentlemen. We got to talk more about this. Tolu, you've covered the Florida insurance industry for a long time in Tallahassee, and this week a new chairman of Citizens Property Insurance was named, Chris Gardner. What do we know about him and what he brings to Citizens?
Well, he actually was already on the board, so he does bring a good amount of experience with the way Citizens operates. He is an insurance broker who has been in the industry for about 20 years. He was appointed chairman by Jeff Atwater, the CFO of Florida. And he said pretty clearly that his plan would be to make Citizens operate in a more transparent fashion. We know that Citizens has been through some mishaps and some missteps in terms of its public image over the last year or so. So he said that his plan is to make Citizens a bit more transparent and make sure that they are operating as they should and not making some of those mistakes that they were making over the last year or so.
Of course, the effort on the part of the executive corps at Citizens has been trying to make that state-backed insurance company smaller, having the smaller risks. Now, you mentioned Jeff Atwater, the chief financial officer for the state of Florida. He recently has asked the state insurance commissioner to explain why Florida insurance rates haven't been impacted as much as one would think, considering that the reinsurance rates that these insurance companies are seeing is lower this year than in years past. Presumably, that would mean lower premiums.
Right. One would wish. Basically, he followed the logic of he's talked to a lot of the insurance industry over the last few years, and their rationale for raising rates the last several years, when we haven't had a hurricane, is that the reinsurance cost, this backup insurance that they're buying, has gone up considerably. Over the last year or so, we've seen those reinsurance costs decline. So Atwater was asking, you know, now that those costs are going down, why is it that that our insurance rates aren't going down?
Has he gotten a response yet, Tolu?
He has got a response. He sent a letter to the insurance commissioner, and he got a response not too long after. Basically, a pretty technical response saying that it's not as simple as apples to apples. Sometimes the insurance industry, even when their costs go down, they're required to buy more of this reinsurance. So that cost savings doesn't get passed on directly to the homeowner right away. That was kind of the gist of the response that he got.
Yeah, and it may be a technical answer, and it may be an answer that is certainly truthful, but does it hold water for consumers? In other words, you know, you've got at the end of the day all these Florida homeowners that have had to rely on Citizens and rely on other private insurers and have not necessarily been able to benefit from the string of quiet storm seasons we've had.
Right. It's a theme that's gone through for so many people that are struggling to pay the high insurance rates we have in Florida, given the fact that we haven't had a storm in more than 7 years. People are looking for a little bit of relief and hoping that, you know, this quiet season would actually translate to lower premiums. We haven't seen that yet. We have seen that the insurance industry has been able to pocket a good amount of money and take in those premiums and make a pretty good profit due to the fact that we've had no storms. So now there's more calls from the politicians that people who are just the everyday consumers should actually get some of that relief as well.
And hopefully that quiet nature of the season will continue. As we just heard from Jeff Huffman, meteorologist of Florida Public Radio in Gainesville, Tropical Storm Erin downgraded from a tropical storm as she weakens way out in the Atlantic. Curtis Morgan with the Miami Herald. Is the Corps still walking the dike at Lake Okeechobee most days?
They're doing weekly inspections. They've identified two very small leaks. I think it's like 2.5 gallons per minute or something. If it hits 16.5, they will start daily inspections.
16.5 feet for
yes.
The lake level. Gotcha. All right. Curtis Morgan covering environmental issues for the Miami Herald. Tolu Olorunipa covering all things insurance and water related from Tallahassee for Bloomberg News. Join us at 800-743-WLRN here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-9576. Email at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. Tweet us at WLRN or go to the live chat at WLRN.org. Still to come on the Florida Roundup, burying a teenager a week after he was tasered by Miami Beach police. And later in the program, the world's biggest retailer gets closer to opening in the city of Miami. Welcome back. It's the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Your questions, of course, welcome at 800-743-WLRN. Our live blog joining the conversation at WLRN.org. Israel Hernandez was buried this week, a week after being chased, then tasered by Miami Beach police. We heard the 911 call of his arrest.
Attention units, 0783 response, subject in custody, 71 in Harding. 0783 response, 71 in Harding, subject in custody, 520 Miami Beach.
537, are you all right?
Yes, good.
I don't know if the guy's having a seizure. We'll fire rescue on a breathing. He is breathing.
You can hear the police officer speaking with dispatch there. Are you all right? He is breathing, we hear there. The tape also shows that Hernandez was running from police officers for several minutes before he was caught. Now, the officer involved in the tasering is on paid administrative leave. The case remains under investigation. The Miami Beach police chief defended his department's response.
They had an encounter. They were going to place somebody under arrest for a crime. Even though it was only graffiti, it's still a crime. The subject ran from him. Now he's eluding police. You know, it's a resisting arrest, if you will. There were several times that Mr. Hernandez had the opportunity to give himself up.
We've got a couple of Florida's finest journalists to talk about this case now. Michael Miller from Miami New Times, who broke the original Hernandez story, and Hannah Sampson of the Miami Herald. Mike, you broke this story originally a better part of a week ago. What have we learned about the circumstances now leading up to the tasering?
Well, we've learned a little bit in terms of, we know from the 911 tape that he was running around for about 7 minutes, eluding the cops, kind of running all over that North Beach neighborhood. And we also know that, you can hear on there that the cop immediately says, "Are you all right?" Mm-hmm. So they seem surprised that suddenly he's not doing well. There's no mentioning of tasering actually on the 911 tape. And also the only police report that's really been released is one from a cop who did not see the tasering himself. So yeah. I think, really we know some of the circumstances, but we don't really know what happened in that instant when he was tasered and whether cops could have avoided it.
You've reported on law enforcement for some time. The fact that we haven't seen an official full police report yet, is that standard procedure?
I don't think it's that unusual. I mean, to be honest, I've reported on stories about, multiple murders, and they haven't released a report 2-3 years later. I mean, it depends on the department, but right. I don't think it's that unusual. And in fact, I mean, I actually am surprised and, pleasantly surprised that they've released as much information as they have so far. Obviously,
Now, describe that pleasantly surprised. Why? Because of the history of fatal police encounters in Miami Beach and the opaqueness that the department has had in regards to public documents.
Yeah, I mean, both of those. When you think of recent kind of scandals involving the department, you think of the 2011, I believe, Memorial Day weekend shooting.
Right.
There was a lot of kind of, I won't say misinformation, but a lot of confusion over what actually happened. I don't believe there's actually been a full report released yet on that, even though there's many lawsuits. One person died, many bystanders were injured in the shooting. Cops rattled off something like 130 bullets, and then I think about a month later there was the ATV accident where
on the beach. A tourist was hit and killed.
Yeah, by a cop who was drunk at the time. It was something like 4 a.m. and partying and ran over a couple of people. So, you have a couple of incidents like that which have stirred up a lot of anger against cops on the beach, and the police force hasn't always been really forthcoming with details about that. But, now there's a new police chief and he seems to be doing, a slightly better job. So,
Michael Miller with Miami New Times discussing the Miami Beach police response to several incidences through the years. But most recently, Mike, you've covered this Israel Hernandez tasering, which ended with the teenager dying. What have we learned about the officer involved?
The officer, Jorge Mercado, he's I think a 13-year veteran. And, we just got the details on his case, his file yesterday. And, they show that he has 6 internal affairs investigations or complaints against him. One of them is this tasering of the 18-year-old tagger, Israel Hernandez.
So he had 5 previous incidences before being involved with the,
and
one of those Hernandez case.
Yeah, and one of those is pretty bizarre, actually. Julie K. Brown, I think, had some details on it today in the Herald. She said that the FDLE has some records showing that he tested positive for a painkiller, and that was a pretty serious offense. He was suspended for quite a long time, nearly lost his job over that. But the more relevant complaints there are that in 2008, Mercado, this officer, was accused of being one of a couple officers to kind of break into a hotel room trying to arrest these two Iraq war veterans, and one of them was tased, and they were both allegedly beaten, and they later complained to their congressman about it. So, you know, that one I think kind of raises red flags because it's a previous instance of tasering, right, and perhaps excessive force by the officer. So, you know, people who are kind of up in arms over Hernandez's death, you know, could look at that and say he has a history of maybe going too far, of using his taser, you know, when he didn't have to. But again, you know, it's not exactly clear in that instant whether he had to use the weapon or not.
Sure, there's going to be questions about circumstances in regards to the use of force, but there's also questions, Hanna, about the questions of the truthfulness of the officer here involved in the Hernandez case. Again, back to the record that's been released and reporting in the Miami Herald, reprimanded by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, flunking a drug test. We learned, in fact, that he was involved with the overtime scandal, where he collected $66,000 of overtime pay, when at certain times during that OT that he charged the city and its taxpayers for, he was actually on vacation in Orlando. In another instance, he was at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Hollywood. So, you know, the question is going to be asked by the public and certainly by the press, Hanna. Are we being appropriately scrutinizing the Miami Beach police, or focused perhaps on this one incident and this one officer that clearly does have some kind of track record of behavior that has fallen under investigation in the past?
Well, and I should say I've been following this but not covering it. I'm a resident of Miami Beach, and I think these issues that you raise are part of why it was a good move for the chief to call in independent investigators, as I think it was pretty quickly as he did, to call in the FDLE. Because then you can kind of take out some of those questions of Miami Beach Police Department and put it on another agency. But when you come to the truthfulness of the officer involved, I mean, he was there, the young man who died, you know, he's not around to tell his side of the story. So even though you have outside people coming in to investigate, there's still that central question of the person who is actually the one firing the taser. Is he telling the truth, and what's his background as far as that's concerned?
And what were the circumstances leading up to the tasering? I think just very basic questions still remain unanswered in this case for all parties involved. This is the Florida Roundup. Part of your conversation is, of course, always welcome. Be sure to join us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, or tweet us at WLRN. We're on Facebook and the website WLRN.org with a live discussion curated by our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrell. Hanna, you mentioned as a resident of Miami Beach, last weekend, we saw a pretty vocal response in the part of the community at the site of the tasering. Is this an incident that is becoming in focus in the minds of some residents after the case of the Urban Beach Week shooting in 2011, after the case of the ATV running over the tourist in a fatal accident by a Miami Beach police officer on the beach? In other words, describe to me as a resident the confidence that that residents may have in their police department and law enforcement.
You know, I think it's really mixed, and I think it goes beyond the city of Miami Beach also, because last weekend I was in Wynwood, for example, and as the New Times has pointed out, there are tags RIP Rifa, which is what the nickname of the young man who died, all over the city. So that's kind of extended beyond the city limits. As a resident, you know, I encounter police officers who are maybe taking a sandwich out of their bag and giving it to a homeless guy on the street. You see a lot of goodwill there. But there's also a history, you know, of residents who live in the beach every Memorial Day weekend, dealing with the overwhelming amount of police officers and kind of the police state mentality there. And I think a lot of people feel like maybe that's overkill, maybe they blame the weekend and what it's become. But there's definitely questions and uncertainty about the department and its track record. And hopefully there's been some improvement in that area.
All right. Join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup. The phone number, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Chris is joining us from Deerfield Beach. Chris, welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What can we do?
Well, I just wanted to weigh on in this conversation. I feel that when it comes to police officers, I think they should be as accountable as any other job. I mean, as an employee of a business, if you fail a drug test or you get found committing overtime fraud, how do you maintain a job? Why are you still an employee?
Great question, Chris. Michael, how about it? What do we know about the role of investigations into what we've seen with the officer's record, personnel record, essentially, that's been made public now?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only thing I can really say on that is that, you know, police unions are quite powerful. I mean, you know, they fight tooth and nail to keep their, you know, officers employed and, you know, from their perspective, rightly so. But I think we've seen, you know, multiple instances, including on the beach. I mean, I think you had a couple of officers who were fired a couple of years ago for a beating a man, I think a gay man near Flamingo Park, a tourist. And they were, you know, one of them at least was recently reinstated. So, I mean, you do have very powerful police, you know, unions who fight for their officers. And, you know, sometimes you have incidents that people think, yeah, exactly like the caller, like how could this guy still be employed? And they come back. So it's, you know.
Is this an area of investigation for state investigators? I guess, in other words, Michael, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement investigating its own, an internal investigation to some degree, although it's an outside agency. It's not in Miami Beach. Is this the kind of question that it's going to have to ask and kind of question, quite frankly, that Miami Beach law enforcement leaders are going to have to come up with an answer beyond just the union contract?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know where I read, but that there was kind of a good point, and you know, Hannah brings it up as well with the FDLE coming in. You know, now the scrutiny will turn to the beach and their police force, and it's certainly not what you know, Chief Martinez wanted right now. He's only, what, I think about a year into his job, but you know, a lot of that focus has been on Miami Police Department and some of their shootings and fatal police involved shootings the last, you know, 3-4 years. And you know, I think they have a lot of questions to answer, not only about this case, but about, you know, the kind of string of incidents of maybe poor judgment by cops.
Anna, I want you to address the idea that this case clearly has tapped into a community concern well beyond the Miami Beach neighborhood in which it happened. I mean, you mentioned in Wynwood last weekend seeing the graffiti tags and seeing other rest in peace art or street art in reference to Reefa. What is it about this case? What is it about the Israel Hernandez that seems to have really struck a chord and folks in certain communities really standing up and becoming much more vocal about it?
I mean, I think you look at who this teenager was, and Mike will know this better than I, but from what I've read and all of the forums that I've looked at, he seemed to have a really promising future. You've got two sides of the coin where people say he was committing a crime, he ran from the police, he deserved what he got. And then you have the people who said he was putting street art, which some people pay for, on an abandoned building in a section of Miami Beach that was not the Art Deco section. And he was, you know, an artist and he was beloved at his school. And so I think that kind of profile really highlights what a great loss this was and what a tragedy it was, you know, regardless of how it went down. Nobody clearly wanted this outcome. So I think it really has pulled out a lot of emotion for that reason.
Yeah, police, law enforcement, certainly the artist community, the parental community, and the greater community at large. Nobody would want this kind of outcome.
No.
Not at all. Hanna Sampson is along with us from the Miami Herald. Michael Miller from Miami New Times. Join us as well at 800-743-WLRN here on the Florida Roundup. 1-800-743-9576. You can tweet us at WLRN. And of course, the ongoing conversation online, curated by our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow, at WLRN.org. The world's largest retailer is now one step closer this week to opening in the city of Miami. The city approved plans for a Walmart in Midtown Miami. This has been years in the making, Michael. Where do the plans stand now? Are shovels going to go into the ground?
Well, I think we're a little ways away from that still. The head of planning here in the city of Miami, Francisco Garcia, he has given the go-ahead in terms of the architectural plans for Walmart, which are unto themselves very controversial. It's nearly 160,000 square feet store. So, I mean, this is, I think, most of the 5-acre plot there. I mean, this is a big, huge development. But it still will probably be appealed by the opponents of Walmart. They're going to appeal the decision to approve the plans. And then also the Walmart has to go another step and get a building permit before they can really break ground.
While 160,000 square feet is a large store, no doubt about it. For a Walmart, that's a mini mart.
Yeah.
Let's face it, right?
Right.
A Walmart is usually on the scale of several hundred thousand square feet. So what types of architectural plans have you seen that kind of, I suppose, let us know that Walmart may be paying some close attention to where they want to put their store here in this district in Miami?
Yeah, I mean, Walmart actually tried to come into this area in 2005, and it was rejected by the city commission. But, you know, this time around, they have made a lot of concessions when you look at their plans. You know, it doesn't really look like your typical Walmart. I mean, I'm from Missouri. I've seen many Walmarts in my life. And, you know, it has kind of a fancy facade. Walmart has agreed to kind of line the street with other stores. So actually letting other, you know, businesses, you know, boutiques or whatever they might be kind of sell there on the street. So it's kind of almost a hidden Walmart. But, you know, some of the problems with bringing a Walmart in are kind of unavoidable. I mean, I think the plans have called for, you know, expanding, you know, widening the street and having trucks come in at, you know, all hours and things like that.
Sure. You got to keep the store shelves stocked here. But Walmart doesn't exist in a vacuum if it happens to go in this neighborhood. There are other big box retailers. Marshall's is in there. You've got a Target in there. So this kind of semi-truck traffic, you know, overnight is already there to help supply these stores.
I think that's kind of true. I mean, my sense is that it will be a significant increase when Walmart comes in. I mean, I think a lot of people, kind of the heart of the debate here is that a lot of people, they talk about Midtown and they see Midtown becoming kind of a more dense, livable area. Yeah. You know, there are condos that have gone in. And if you look at, you know, since Target came in, I don't know when that was, you look at the businesses that have started up there, and yes, there are other big retailers, but you also have kind of restaurants, you know, mm-hmm. Gigi and Sugarcane mm-hmm. and Bardot nearby. So I think the direction that most people who really frequent the neighborhood want it to go in is much different than Walmart and what Walmart is as a symbol too, which is very, you know, powerful and controversial.
Yeah, absolutely. Join us here on the Florida Roundup. Let us know what you think. It is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Grant is joining us from Miami. Grant, what do you think about Walmart coming to your city?
I think Walmart's plan is awful. It's not like other big box retailers, and they have flat out not met the code standards for Midtown Miami. Not even in the slightest. And if you look at the picture that's circulated, the picture with the storefront, you can see it right there in the picture.
Grant, what are you referring to in terms of it not being able to meet the standards for Midtown Miami?
First of all, they're widening the street. The standard specifically says that there's not any allowable widening of that street, period. 31st Street is meant to be two lanes, two bays of parallel parking, and extensive protection for pedestrians. That's number one. Number two, they have five loading zones in an area that's only zoned for three, no more, no less. And even worse, they have a situation where they may not be ADA compliant because their entire project has a very large, oversized parking garage that does not have any elevator, escalator access on the east side of the project.
Grant, you're certainly very vocal about Walmart in Midtown, but let me ask you, if the street wasn't widened, if the loading docks were reduced, and if the elevators and escalators were ADA compliant, would you be the first one through the door if it opens up?
That's not even the end of the list. There's missing second floor setbacks. There's missing active liner uses for the second floor. And worse than that, there's no unified design plan. Their Walmart plan has two completely different buildings abutting each other, and it's completely against the code of Midtown Miami.
Grant, do you have a problem with Walmart? Do you have a problem with Walmart?
Listen, I have many problems with Walmart. They don't pay a living wage, and they're a very, very poor neighbor.
Grant joining us from the city of Miami discussing the Midtown plans for the possibility of a Walmart going in there. And Hannah, he puts voice to certainly a lot of justified concerns, both in terms of the architectural nature of the plans for Walmart, some of the concerns about how it's going to impact the neighborhood. But there's also a certain portion of critics that are very critical of Walmart and its business practices.
Sure. And I mean, the marketplace is kind of not treating Walmart all that well this week either. They had earnings this week that have been described as disastrous. And their stock has been responding to that. So they really are a reflection of the broader economy. And when you, I mean, I think that Walmart has been trying to adapt, and Grant and other opponents will say that they haven't adapted well enough to the codes of that area. But when you look at the traditional image of Walmart, as Mike pointed out, it's, you know, it's not the upscale kind of posh environment that that Midtown residents are looking for. So, I mean, you know, there's a host of problems. I think that Walmart has been making an effort, but seems like they still have a way to go.
Yeah, well, certainly they still have some time to do it, too, and not only convince the local residents in that neighborhood, but also regulators in the city of Miami. We've got Hannah Sampson with the Miami Herald, Michael Miller with Miami New Times along with us. It is the Florida Roundup, and still to come on our program, Uncle Sam looks to block a big airline merger. American Airlines and U.S. Airways had been weeks away from combining before the Justice Department this week sued to stop it. The Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. First, Delta Airlines merged with Northwest Airlines, then Continental and United Airlines combined, and American and U.S. Airways had planned on joining forces before the end of this year, at least until this week, when the U.S. Justice Department sued to block the airline merger. Now, several states also joined this lawsuit, including Florida, signaling the first time the government has moved to stop an airline merger in more than a decade. Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi called the proposed merger, quote, anti-competitive and harmful to consumers. Now, the U.S. Assistant Attorney Bill Baer is leading the suit on behalf of the U.S. government.
While shareholders might benefit, creditors might benefit, the fact of the matter is consumers will get the shaft.
That is the Assistant U.S. Attorney Bill Baer, who's leading the effort to block American Airlines and U.S. Airways from merging. This has potentially significant impact here in Miami, where American is the biggest tenant at Miami International Airport. We've got Joe Bracantelli, travel business columnist for the business journals, including the South Florida Business Journal, and Hannah Sampson still with us covering travel and all things hospitality from the Miami Herald. Joe, first of all, what's the central complaint on the part of the Justice Department that this merger would harm consumers?
Well, what they're saying, Tom, is that basically you might actually look at this and say this is their apology for allowing the earlier mergers, because they're saying enough is enough. We will not allow an industry to have three big players only. And they prefer clearly the same solution they imposed on AT&T and T-Mobile when they tried to merge. They blocked that merger for the same reason. The industry believes three big players are the best way to compete. DOJ said this week, no, we'd rather have a mix of big players and slightly smaller players fighting it out in the market.
So is the problem for American and U.S. Airways that they were just late? They weren't first or second in this trend to merge on the airline industry?
It depends on how you look at it, Tom. You could make that case. Intelligent people could look at that lawsuit and say, yes. On the other hand, you could say the DOJ has looked at how other mergers have worked, by the way, including U.S. Airways, which is a combination of six previous mergers, and said, you know what, mergers don't work so well for consumers.
Hannah, what has been the reaction at all from the airlines? Because they still continue to push forward toward the merger. This is a lawsuit. A judge is the one that has to actually grant the injunction to actually block it. In the meantime, American Airlines is still in bankruptcy.
Yeah, and they had a hearing yesterday, and their plan was that that would be when they would exit bankruptcy with the seal of approval on the merger, the exit from bankruptcy, the restructuring, all of that. I would categorize the response as defiant on the part of the airlines. The lawyers for both of the lines had a conference call the day after the DOJ suit, and they said essentially, well, we're willing to listen to any ideas that justice has for a settlement, but we're very prepared to fight this out in court. And they made several points to rebut the Department of Justice suit, saying, in fact, that the merger would be good for competition, yeah, as Joe just mentioned, and that many of the points that the DOJ made in their suit were irrelevant or false or exaggerations. So they're not taking it laying down.
A lot of these antitrust cases, Joe, get down to defining your market. I remember when Sirius Satellite Radio wanted to get it. They were the only two players in satellite radio, but they defined the market to include iPods and MP3 players, and Department of Justice said okay. So is there some definition of the market that the Department of Justice wants on these legacy air carriers, where they don't want to include a Southwest or an Allegiant Airlines or some of the even Alaska Airlines, smaller regional players that American and U.S. Airways want to?
Well, you know, Tom, without trying to be too macro about it, this could also go back to your previous discussion about does Miami want a Walmart? It really depends on the kind of industry and companies you want playing in what is the big sandbox of competition. I'll give you a perfect local example. At Miami, American Airlines is now 78% of the market. U.S. Airways is a very small player. If the airlines are allowed to merge, that would be 82% of the Miami airport market in the hands of one airline. You go a few miles up the road at Fort Lauderdale, you have four different airlines having at least 15% of the market. That includes a legacy carrier like Delta, a traditional low-cost carrier like Southwest, an upstart, a disruptive upstart like JetBlue, and Spirit Airlines. I don't know what is the best for the country. I'm not smart enough to claim I do know. So you either want the kind of market we have in Miami now and that expanded if there's a merger, or you go up the road to Fort Lauderdale and you see four players slugging it out fairly successfully.
Joe Brocantelli, that's
the choice we make.
Joe Brocantelli is with us. He's with the Business Journal's. Hanna Sampson covers travel for the Miami Herald. Hanna, to Joe's point, American already arguably has the monopoly at Miami International, almost 80% of the traffic, another 2% or so from U.S. Airways. Doesn't really move the needle that much, whether you have 78% of the traffic or 82% of the traffic. You're still the majority player.
They are, and I believe it's closer to 70% in Miami, but they are. I mean, they're clearly the powerhouse, and what they say the benefit of this merger would be, and again, all we have is what they say, so we don't know how things would actually play out, but they say that would give them more power in the regions where they're weak, in the northeast of the U.S., and that their plan would be to continue adding service from Miami, which they say will be beneficial to Miami and to all of the hubs that it connects to in South America and the Caribbean.
Joe, is this a delaying tactic? Does the Department of Justice want something out of this merger that it currently doesn't have?
That's a real good question, Tom, and no one knows the answer. If you read the complaint, you could see a path for this merger to be done. Weirdly, there's much less concentration at Washington National Airport, where U.S. Air and American Airlines would have something like two-thirds of the slots. The government has always worried more about Washington National because they always want Aunt Martha. No, they always want Aunt Martha to be able to get, you know, the local congressman.
It's the home market. Yeah, it's the home market for the Department of Justice. Right.
So you could see where there'd be an opportunity for. Also, the other problem is National Airport is slot controlled. There's not free entry as there is in Miami or Fort Lauderdale. So you could see where the government might say, okay, give us back X percent of the slots you have and we'll let you have this merger. But other people have said, look at AT&T and T-Mobile. The government now says there's too much combination and too much concentration in a lot of these markets. And as I say, in Miami, when you add American Airlines itself and its American Eagle commuter carrier, it's already 78% of the market.
Joe, are you a window and aisle guy?
I'm an aisle guy.
All right. Joe Brocantelli along with us. He's with the Business Journals. Hanna, how about you? Window, middle, or aisle?
Always window if I can get it.
Always window. I'll be in the aisle even if it's row 30 for that point. Hanna Sampson along with us from the Miami Herald. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Monday on the Sunshine Economy, it is back to school for hundreds of thousands of South Florida kids. We talk with the superintendents of Miami-Dade and Broward County Schools and also hear from teachers.
I've spent over $200 just at the beginning of this school year, which hasn't even started yet, on those supplies that will make activities more engaging for my kids.
It's the Sunshine Economy Monday at 9 a.m. here on WLRN. And next week, we'll also be bringing you stories about Cuban kitchens. We want a seat at your table. So be sure to share your stories, your memories, your recipes, your menus at WLRN.org on Facebook and Twitter as well. Just use that hashtag, Cuban Kitchen. This is the Florida Roundup. It will be rebroadcast tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. and, of course, archived on the website at WLRN.org. Produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman, our intern Isabella Charde, Public Insight Network analyst Steph Farrow, our executive producer here at WLRN, Peter J. Mertz, our technical supervisor making the trains run on time, Paul Leary. Be sure to stay around. South Florida Arts Beat is next with singer, songwriter, musician Elston Torres singing songs of life and love live in our studios right here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.